that the fear of poverty is one of man's inherited fears, or that this fear has its origin in man's nature to cheat his fellow man, would be similar to trying to prove that 3 times 2 are 6. Obviously, no man would ever fear poverty if he had any grounds for trusting his fellow man. For there is food and shelter and raiment and luxury of every nature sufficient for the needs of every person on earth. And all these blessings would be enjoyed by every person except for the swinish habit that man has of trying to push all the other swine out of the trough, even after he has had all and more than he needs. The second of the 6 basic fears with which man is bound is the fear of old age. In the main, this fear grows out of 2 sources. First, the thought that old age may bring with it poverty. Secondly, and by far the most common source of origin, from false and cruel sectarian teaching, which have been so well mixed with fire and brimstone, and with purgatories and other boogies, that human beings have learned to fear old age, because it meant the approach of another, and possibly a much more horrible world than this one, which is known to be bad enough. In the basic fear of old age, man has 2 very sound reasons for his apprehension. The one growing out of distrust of his fellow men, who may seize whatever worldly goods he may possess, and the other arising from the terrible pictures of the world to come, which are deeply planted in his mind, through the law of social heredity, long before he came into possession of that mind. Is it any wonder, then, that man fears the approach of old age? The third of the 6 basic fears is the fear of criticism. Just how man acquired this basic fear would be hard, if not impossible, definitely to determine. But one thing is certain, he has it in well-developed form. Some believe that this fear made its appearance in the mind of man about the time that politics came into existence. Others believe its source can be traced no further than the first meeting of an organization of females, known as a woman's club. Still another school of humorists charges the origin to the contents of the Holy Bible, whose pages abound with some very vitriolic and violent forms of criticism. If the latter claim is correct, and those who believe literally all they find in the Bible are not mistaken, then God is responsible for man's inherent fear of criticism, because God caused the Bible to be written. This author, being neither a humorist nor a prophet, but just an ordinary workaday type of person, is inclined to attribute the basic fear of criticism to that part of man's inherited nature which prompts him not only to take away his fellow man's goods and wares, but to justify his action by criticism of his fellow man's character. The fear of criticism takes on many different forms, the majority of which are petty and trivial in nature, even to the extent of being childish in the extreme. Bald-headed men, for example, are bald for no other reason than their fear of criticism. Heads become bald because of the protection of hats with tight-fitting bands which cut off the circulation at the roots of the hair. Men wear hats not because they actually need them for the sake of comfort, but mainly because everybody's doing it, and the individual falls in line and does it also, lest some other individual criticize him. Women seldom have bald heads, or even thin hair, because they wear hats that are loose, the only purpose of which is to make an appearance. But it must not be imagined that women are free from the fear of criticism associated with hats. If any woman claims to be superior to man with reference to this fear, ask her to walk down the street wearing a hat that is 1 or 2 seasons out of style. The makers of all manner of clothing have not been slow to capitalize this basic fear of criticism, with which all mankind is cursed. Every season it will be observed the styles in many articles of wearing apparel change. Who established the styles? Certainly not the purchaser of clothes, but the manufacturer of clothes. Why does he change the style so often? Obviously this change is made so that the manufacturer can sell more clothes. For the same reason, the manufacturers of automobiles, with a few rare and very sensible exceptions, change styles every season. The manufacturer of clothing knows how the man animal fears to wear a garment which is 1 season out of step with that which they are all wearing now. Is this not true? does not your own experience back it up? We have been describing the number in which people behave under the influence of the fear of criticism, as applied to the small and petty things of life. Let us now examine human behavior under this fear when it affects people in connection with the more important matters connected with human intercourse. Take, for example, practically any person who has reached the age of mental maturity, from 35 to 45 years of age is a general average. And if you could read his or her mind, you would find in that mind a very decided disbelief of and a rebellion against most of the fables taught by the majority of the religionists. Powerful and mighty is the fear of criticism. The time was, and not so very long ago, that when the word infidel meant ruin to whomsoever it was applied, it is seen, therefore, that man's fear of criticism is not without ample cause for its existence. The fourth basic fear is that of the fear of loss of love of someone. The source from which this fear originated needs but little description, for it is obvious that it grew out of man's nature to steal his fellow man's mate, or at least to take liberties with her, unknown to her rightful lord and master. By nature, all men are polygamous, the statement of which will, of course, bring denials from those who are either too old to function in a normal way sexually, or have, from some other cause, lost the contents of certain glands which are responsible for man's tendency toward the plurality of the opposite sex. There can be little doubt that jealousy and all other similar forms or more or less mild dementia, insanity, grew out of man's inherited fear of the loss of love of someone. Of all the sane fools studied by this author, that represented by a man who has become jealous of some woman, or that of a woman who has become jealous of some man, is the oddest and strangest. The author, fortunately, never had but one case of personal experience with this form of insanity, but from the experience he learned enough to justify him in stating that the fear of loss of love of someone is one of the most painful, if not in fact the most painful of all of the six most basic fears. And it seems reasonable to add that this fear plays more havoc with the human mind than do any of the other six basic fears, often leading to the more violent forms of permanent insanity. The fifth basic fear is that of the fear of ill health. This fear has its origin, to considerable extent also, in the same sources from which the fear of poverty and old age are derived. The fear of ill health must needs be closely associated with both poverty and old age, because it also leads toward the borderline of terrible worlds, of which man knows not, but of which he has heard some discomforting stories. The author strongly suspects that those engaged in the business of selling good health methods have had considerable to do with keeping the fear of ill health alive in the human mind. For longer than the record of the human race can be relied upon, the world has known of various and sundry forms of therapy and health purveyors. If a man gains his living from keeping people in good health, it seems but natural that he would use every means at his command for persuading people that they needed his services. Thus, in time, it might be that people would inherit a fear of ill health. The sixth and last of the six basic fears is that of the fear of death. To many, this is the worst of all the six basic fears, and the reason why it is so regarded becomes obvious to even the casual student of psychology. The terrible pangs of fear associated with death may be charged directly to religious fanaticism, the source which is more responsible for it than are all other sources combined. So-called heathen are not as much afraid of death as are the civilized, especially that portion of the civilized population which has come under the influence of theology. For hundreds of millions of years, man has been asking the still unanswered, and it may be the unanswerable question, whence and whither? Where did I come from, and where am I going after death? The more cunning and crafty, as well as the honest but credulous of the race, have not been slow to offer the answer to these questions. In fact, the answering of these questions has become one of the so-called learned professions, despite the fact that but little learning is required to enter this profession. Witness now the major source of the origin of the fear of death. Come into my tent, embrace my faith, accept my dogmas, and pay my salary, and I will give you a ticket that will admit you straightway into heaven when you die, says the leader of one form of sectarianism. Remain out of my tent, says the same leader, and you will go directly to hell, where you will burn throughout eternity. While in fad the self-appointed leader may not be able to provide self-conduct into heaven, nor lack of such provision allow the unfortunate seeker after truth to descend into hell, the possibility of the latter seems so terrible that if it lays hold of the mind and creates that fear of fears, the fear of death. In truth, no man knows, and no man has ever known, what heaven or hell is like, or if such places exist. And this very lack of definitive knowledge opens the door of the human mind to the charlatan to enter and control that mind with his stock of legend and various brands of trickery, deceit, and fraud. The truth is this, nothing less and nothing more, that no man knows, nor has any man ever known, where we come from at birth or where we go at death. Any person claiming otherwise is either deceiving himself, or he is a conscious impostor who makes it a business to live without rendering service of value through play upon the credulity of humanity. Be it said in their behalf, however, the majority of those engaged in selling tickets into heaven actually believe not only that they know where heaven exists, but that their creeds and formulas will give safe passage to all who embrace them. This belief may be summed up in one word, credulity. Religious leaders generally make the broad, sweeping claim that the present civilization owes its existence to the work done by the churches. This author, as far as he is personally concerned, is willing to grant their claims to be correct, if, at the same time, he be permitted to add that even if this claim be true, the theologians haven't a great deal of which to brag. But it is not, cannot be true that civilization has grown out of the efforts of the organized churches and creeds. If by the term civilization is meant the uncovering of the natural laws and the many inventions to which the world is the present heir. If the theologians wish to claim that part of civilization which has to do with man's conduct toward his fellow man, they are perfectly welcome to it. As far as his author is concerned, but on the other hand, if they presume to gobble up the credit for all the scientific discovery of mankind, the author begs leave to offer vigorous protest. It is hardly sufficient to state that social heredity is the method through which man gathers all knowledge that reaches him through the five senses. It is more to the point to state how social heredity works, in as many different applications as will give the student a comprehensive understanding of that law. Let us begin with some of the lower forms of animal life and examine the manner in which they are affected by the law of social heredity. Shortly after this author began to examine the major sources from which men gather the knowledge which makes them what they are, some 30-odd years ago, he discovered the nest of a ruffed grouse. The nest was so located that the mother bird could be seen from a considerable distance when she was on the nest. With the aid of a pair of field glasses, the bird was closely watched until the young birds were hatched out. It happened that the regular daily observation was made but a few hours after the young birds came out of the shell. Desiring to know what would happen, the author approached the nest. The mother remained near until the intruder was within 12 or 15 feet of her. Then she disarranged her feathers, stretched one wing over her leg, and went hobbling away, making a pretense of being crippled. Being somewhat familiar with the tricks of the mother bird, the author did not follow, but instead went to the nest to take a look at the little ones. Without the slightest signs of fear, they turned their eyes towards him, moving their heads first one way and then another. He reached down and picked one of them up. With no signs of fear, it stood in the palm of his hand. He laid the bird back in the nest and went away to a safe distance to give the mother bird a chance to return. The wait was short. Very soon she began cautiously to edge her way back toward the nest until she was in a few feet, when she spread her wings and ran as fast as she could, uttering, meanwhile, a series of sounds similar to those of a hen when she was found some morsel of food and wishes to call her brood to partake of it. She gathered the little birds around and continued to quiver in a highly excited manner, shaking her wings and ruffling her feathers. One could almost hear her words as she gave the little birds their first lesson in self-defense, through the law of social heredity. "You silly little creatures, do you not know that men are your enemies? Shame on you for allowing that man to pick you up in his hands. It's a wonder he didn't carry you off and eat you alive. The next time you see a man approaching, make yourself scarce. Lie down on the ground, run under leaves, go anywhere to get out of sight, and remain out of sight until the enemy is well on his way." The little birds stood around and listened to the lecture with interest intense. After the mother bird had quieted down, the author again started to approach the nest. Within 20 feet or so of the guarded household, the mother bird again started to lead him in the other direction by crumpling up her wing and hobbling along as if she was crippled. He looked at the nest, but the glance was in vain. The little birds were nowhere to be found. They had learned rapidly to avoid their natural enemy, thanks to their natural instinct. Again the author retreated, awaited until the mother bird had reassembled her household, then came out to visit them, but with similar results. When he approached the spot where he last saw the mother bird, not the slightest signs of the little fellows were to be found. When a small boy, the author captured a young crow and made a pet of it. The bird became quite well satisfied with its domestic surroundings and learned to perform many tricks requiring considerable intelligence. After the bird was big enough to fly, it was permitted to go wherever it pleased. Sometimes it would be gone for many hours, but it always returned home after dark. One day, some wild crows became involved in a fight with an owl in a field near the house where the pet crow lived. As soon as the pet heard the caw, caw, caw of its wild relatives, it flew up on top of the house and, with signs of great agitation, walked from one end of the house to the other. Finally, it took wing and flew in the direction of the battle. The author followed to see what would happen. In a few minutes, he came up with the pet. It was sitting on the lower branches of a tree, and two wild crows were sitting on a limb just above, chattering and walking back and forth, acting very much in the same fashion that angry parents behave toward their offspring when chastising them. As the author approached, the two wild crows flew away, one of them circling around the tree a few times, meanwhile letting out a terrible flow of most abusive language, which no doubt was directed at its foolish relative who hadn't enough sense to fly while the flying was good. The pet was called, but it paid no attention. That evening it returned home, but would not come near the house. It sat on a high limb of an apple tree and talked in crow language for about 10 minutes, saying no doubt that it decided to go back to the wild life of its fellows, then flew away and did not return until 2 days later, when it came back and did some more talking in crow language, keeping at a safe distance. Meanwhile, it then went away and never returned. Social heredity had robbed the author of a fine pet. The only consolation he got from the loss of his crow was a thought that it had shown fine sportsmanship by coming back and giving notice of its intention to depart. Many farmhands had left the farm without going to the trouble of this formality. It is a well-known fact that a fox will prey upon all manner of fowl and no small animals with the exception of the skunk. No reason need be stated as to why Mr. Skunk enjoys humanity. A fox may tackle a skunk once, but never twice. For this reason, a skunk may hide when nailed to a chicken roost, will keep all but the very young and inexperienced foxes at a safe distance. The odor of a skunk, once experienced, is never to be forgotten. No other smell even remotely resembles it. It is nowhere recorded that any mother fox ever taught her young how to detect and keep away from the familiar smell of the skunk, but all who are informed of the fox lore know that foxes and skunks never seek lodgment in the same cave. But one lesson is sufficient to teach the fox all that it cares to know about skunks. Through the law of social heredity, operating via the sense of smell, one lesson serves for an entire lifetime. A bullfrog can be caught on a fish hook by attaching a small piece of red cloth or any other small red object to the hook and dangling it in front of the frog's nose. That is, Mr. Frog may be caught in this manner, provided he is hooked the first time he snaps at the bait. But if he is poorly hooked and makes a getaway, or if he feels the point of the hook when he bites at the bait but is not caught, he will never make the same mistake again. The author spent many hours in stealthy attempt to hook a particularly desirable specimen, which had snapped and missed, before learning that but one lesson in social heredity is enough to teach even a humble croaker that bits of red flannel are things to be left alone. The author once owned a very fine male Airedale dog, which caused no end of annoyance by his habit of coming home with a young chicken in his mouth. Each time the chicken was taken away from the dog and he was soundly switched, but to no avail, he continued in his liking for fowl. For the purpose of saving the dog, if possible, and as an experiment with social heredity, this dog was taken to a farm of a neighbor who had a hen and some newly hatched chickens. The hen was placed in the barn and the dog was turned in with her. As soon as everyone was out of sight, the dog slowly edged up toward the hen, sniffed the air in her direction at a time or two to make sure she was the kind of meat for which he was looking, then made a dive for her. Meanwhile, Mrs. Hen had been doing some surveying on her own account, for she met Mr. Dog more than halfway. Moreover, she met him with such a surprise of wings and claws as he had never before experienced. The first round was clearly the hen's, but a nice fat bird, reckoned the dog, was not to slip between his paws so easily. Therefore he backed away a short distance, then charged again. This time Mrs. Hen lit upon his back, drove her claws into his skin, and made effective use of her sharp bill. Mr. Dog retreated to his corner, looking for all the world as if he were listening for someone to ring the bell and call the fight off until he got his bearings. But Mrs. Hen craved no time for deliberation. She had her adversary on the run, and showed that she knew the value of the offensive by keeping him on the run. One could almost understand her words as she flogged the poor Airedale from one corner to another, keeping up a series of rapid-fire sounds which for all the world resembled the remonstrations of an angry mother who had been called upon to defend her offspring from the attack by older boys. The Airedale was a poor soldier. After running around the barn from corner to corner for about 2 minutes, he spread himself on the ground as flat as he could and did his best to protect his eyes with his paws. Mrs. Hen seemed to be making a special attempt to peck out his eyes. The owner of the hen then stepped in and retrieved her, or, more accurately stating it, he retrieved the dog, which in no way appeared to meet with the dog's disapproval. The next day a chicken was placed in the cellar where the dog slept. As soon as he saw the bird, he tucked his tail between his legs and ran for the corner. He never again attempted to catch a chicken. One lesson in social heredity, via the sense of touch, was sufficient to teach him that while chicken chasing may offer some enjoyment, it also fraught with much hazard. All these illustrations, with the exception of the first, describe the process of gathering knowledge through direct experience. Observe the marked difference between knowledge gathered by direct experience and that which is gathered through the training of the young by the old, as in the case of the ruffed grouse and her young. The most impressive lessons are those learned by the young from the old, through highly colored or emotionalized methods of teaching. When the mother grouse spreads her wings, stood her feathers on end, shook herself like a man suffering with the palsy, and chattered to her young in a highly excited manner, she planted the fear of man in their hearts in a manner which they will never soon forget. The term social heredity, as used in connection with this lesson, has particular reference to all methods through which a child is taught any idea, dogma, creed, religion, or system of ethical conduct, by its parents or those who may have authority over it, before reaching the age at which it may reason and reflect upon such teaching in its own way, estimating the age of such reasoning power at, let us say, 7 to 12 years. There are myriads of forms of fear, but none are more deadly than the fear of poverty and old age. We drive our bodies as if they were slaves because we are so afraid of poverty that we wish to hoard money for what? Old age. This common form of fear drives us so hard that we overwork our bodies and bring on the very thing we are struggling to avoid. What a tragedy to watch a man drive himself when he begins to arrive along about the 40-year milepost of life at the age at which he is just beginning to mature mentally. At 40, a man is just entering the age in which he is able to see and understand and assimilate the handwriting of nature, as it appears in the forests and flowing brooks and faces of men and little children. Yet this devil fear drives him so hard that he becomes blinded and lost in the entanglement of a maze of conflicting desires. The principle of organized effort is lost sight of, and instead of laying hold of nature's forces, which are in evidence all around him, and permitting those forces to carry him to the heights of great achievement, he defies them, and they become forces of destruction. Perhaps none of these great forces of nature are more available for man's unfoldment than is the principle of autosuggestion. But ignorance of this force is leading the majority of the human race to apply it so that it acts as a hindrance and not as a help. Let us here enumerate the facts which show just how this misapplication of a great force of nature takes place. Here is a man who meets with some disappointment. A friend proves false, or a neighbor seems indifferent. Forthwith he decides, through self-suggestion, all men are untrustworthy and all neighbors unappreciative. These thoughts so deeply embed themselves in his subconscious mind that they color his whole attitude toward others. Go back now to what was said in Lesson 2 about the dominating thoughts of a man's mind attracting people whose thoughts are similar. Apply the law of attraction, and you will soon see and understand why the unbeliever attracts other unbelievers. Reverse the principle. Here is a man who sees nothing but the best there is in all whom he meets. If his neighbors seem indifferent, he takes no notice of the fact, for he makes it his business to fill his mind with dominating thoughts of optimism and good cheer and faith in others. If people speak to him harshly, he speaks back in tones of softness. Through the operation of this same eternal law of attraction, he draws to himself the attention of people whose attitude towards life and whose dominating thoughts harmonize with his own. Tracing the principle a step further, here is a man who has been well schooled and has the ability to render the world some needed service. Somewhere, sometime, he has heard it said that modesty is a great virtue, and that to push himself to the front of the stage in the game of life savors of egotism. He quietly slips in at the back door and takes a seat at the rear, while other players in the game of life boldly step to the front. He remains in the back row because he fears what they will say. Public opinion, or that which he believes to be public opinion, has him pushed to the rear, and the world hears but little of him. His schooling counts for naught, because he is afraid to let the world know that he has had it. He is constantly suggesting to himself, thus using the great force of auto-suggestion to his own detriment, that he should remain in the background lest he be criticized, as if criticism would do any damage or defeat his purpose. Here is another man who was born of poor parents. Since the first day that he can remember, he has seen evidence of poverty. He has heard talk of poverty. He has felt the icy hand of poverty on his shoulders, and it has so impressed him that he fixes it in his mind as a curse to which he must submit. Quite unconsciously, he permits himself to fall victim of the belief, once poor, always poor, until that belief becomes the dominating thought of his mind. He resembles a horse that has been harnessed and broken until it forgets that it has the potential power with which to throw off that harness. Auto-suggestion is rapidly relegating him to the back of the stage of life. Finally, he becomes a quitter. Ambition is gone. Opportunity comes his way no longer. Or if it does, he has not the vision to see it. He has accepted his fate. It is a well-established fact that the faculties of the mind, like the limbs of the body, atrophy and wither away if not used. Self-confidence is no exception. It develops when used but disappears if not used. One of the chief disadvantages of inherited wealth is the fact that it too often leads to an action and loss of self-confidence. Some years ago, a baby was born to Mrs. E.B. McLean in the city of Washington. His inheritance was said to be around $100 million. When this baby was taken for an airing in his carriage, it was surrounded by nurses and assistant nurses, and detectives and other servants whose duty was to see that no harm befell it. As the years passed by, this same vigilance was kept up. This child did not have to dress himself. He had servants who did that. Servants watched over him while he slept and while he was at play. He was not permitted to do anything that a servant could do for him. He had grown to the age of 10 years. One day he was playing in the yard and noticed that the back gate had been left open. In all of his life, he had never been outside of that gate alone, and naturally that was just the thing that he wished to do. During a moment when the servants were not looking, he dashed out of the gate and was run down and killed by an automobile before he reached the middle of the street. He had used his servants' eyes until his own no longer served him, as they might have done had he learned to rely upon them. 20 years ago, the man whom I served as a secretary sent his 2 sons away to school. One of them went to the University of Virginia, and the other to a college in New York. Each month, it was a part of my task to make out a check for $100 for each of these boys. This was their pin money to be spent as they wished. How profitably I remembered the way I envied these boys as I made out those checks each month. I often wondered why the hand of fate bore me into the world in poverty. I could look ahead and see how these boys would rise to the high stations in life while I remained a humble clerk. In due time, the boys returned home with their sheepskins. Their father was a wealthy man who owned banks and railroads and coal mines and other property of great value. Good positions were waiting for the boys in their father's employ. But 20 years of time can play cruel tricks on those who've never had to struggle. Perhaps a better way to state this truth would be that time gives those who have never had to struggle a chance to play cruel tricks on themselves. At any rate, these 2 boys brought home from school other things besides their sheepskins. They came back with well-developed capacity for strong drink, capacities which they developed because the $100 which each of them received each month made it unnecessary for them to struggle. Theirs is a long and sad story, the details of which will not interest you, but you will be interested in their finny. As this lesson is being written, I have on my desk a copy of the newspaper published in the town where these boys lived. Their father has been bankrupt, and his costly mansion where the boys were born has been placed on the block for sale. One of the boys died of delirium tremors, and the other one is in an insane asylum. Not all rich men's sons turn out so unfortunately, but the fact remains nevertheless that inaction leads to atrophy, and this, in turn, leads to loss of ambition and self-confidence. And without these essential qualities, a man will be carried through life on the wings of uncertainty, just as a dry leaf may be carried here and there on the bosom of the stray winds. Far from being a disadvantage, struggle is a decided advantage, because it develops those qualities which would forever lie dormant without it. Many a man has found his place in the world because of having been forced to struggle for existence early in life. Lack of knowledge of the advantages accruing from struggle has prompted many a parent to say, "I had to work hard when I was young, but I shall see to it that my children have an easy time." Poor foolish creatures! An easy time usually turns out to be a greater handicap than the average young man or woman can survive. There are worse things in this world than being forced to work in early life. Forced idleness is far worse than forced labor. Being forced to work and forced to do your best will breed in you temperance and self-control and strength of will and content and 100 other virtues which the idle will never know. Not only does lack of the necessity for struggle lead to weakness of ambition and willpower, but what is more dangerous still, it sets up in a person's mind a state of lethargy that leads to the loss of self-confidence. The person who has quit struggling because effort is no longer necessary is literally applying the principle of autosuggestion and undermine his own power of self-confidence. Such a person will finally drift into a frame of mind in which he will actually look with more or less contempt upon the person who is forced to carry on. The human mind, if you will pardon repetition, may be likened to an electric battery. It may be positive or it may be negative. Self-confidence is the quality with which the mind is recharged and made positive. Let us apply this line of reasoning to salesmanship and see what part self-confidence plays in this great field of endeavor. One of the greatest salesmen this country has ever seen was once a clerk in the newspaper office. It will be worth your while to analyze the method through which he gained his title as the world's leading salesman. He was a timid young man with a more or less retiring sort of nature. He was one of those who believe it best to slip in by the back door and take a seat at the rear of the stage of life. One evening he heard a lecture on the subject of this lesson, self-confidence, and that lecture so impressed him that he left the lecture hall with a firm determination to pull himself out of the rut into which he had drifted. He went to the business manager of the paper and asked for a position as solicitor of advertising, and was put to work on a commission basis. Everyone in the office expected to see him fail, as this sort of salesmanship calls for the most positive type of sales ability. He went to his room and made a list of a certain type of merchant on whom he intended to call. One would think that he would naturally have made up his list of the names of those whom he believed he could sell with the least effort. But he did nothing of the sort. He placed on his list only the names of the merchants on whom other advertising solicitors had called without making a sale. His list consisted of only 12 names. Before he made a single call, he went out to the city park, took out his list of 12 names, read it over 100 times, saying to himself as he did so, "You will purchase advertising space from me before the end of the month." Then he began to make his calls. The first day he closed sales with 3 of the 12 impossibilities. During the remainder of the week, he made sales to 2 others. By the end of the month, he had opened advertising accounts with all but one of the merchants that he had on a list. For the ensuing month, he made no sales, for the reason that he made no calls except on this one obstinate merchant. Every morning when the store opened, he was on hand to interview this merchant, and every morning the merchant said no. The merchant knew he was not going to buy advertising space, but this young man didn't know it. When the merchant said no, the young man did not hear it, but kept right on coming. On the last day of the month, after having told this persistent young man no for 30 consecutive times, the merchant said, "Look here, young man. You have wasted a whole month trying to sell me. Now, what I would like to know is, why have you wasted your time?" "Wasted my time? Nothing," he retorted. "I have been going to school, and you have been my teacher. Now I know all the arguments that a merchant can bring up for not buying, and besides that, I have been drilling myself in self-confidence." Then the merchant said, "I will make a little confession of my own. I, too, have been going to school, and you have been my teacher. You have taught me a lesson in persistence that is worth money to me, and to show you my appreciation, I am going to pay my tuition fee by giving you an order for advertising space." And that was the way in which the Philadelphia, North America's best advertising account was brought in. Likewise, it marked the beginning of a reputation that has made the same young man a millionaire. He succeeded because he deliberately charged his own mind with sufficient self-confidence to make that mind an irresistible force. When he sat down to make up the list of 12 names, he did something that 99 people out of 100 would not have done. He selected the names of those whom he believed it would be hard to sell, because he understood that out of the resistance he would meet with in trying to sell them would come strength and self-confidence. He was one of the very few people who understood that all rivers and some men are crooked because of following the line of least resistance. I am going to digress and here break a line of thought for a moment while recording a word of advice to the wives of men. Remember, these lines are intended only for the wives, and husbands are not expected to read that which is here set down. From having analyzed more than 16,000 people, the majority of whom were married men, I have learned something that may be of value to wives. Let me state my thoughts in these words. You have it within your power to send your husband away to his work or his business, or his profession each day with a feeling of self-confidence that will carry him successfully over the rough spots of the day and bring him home again at night, smiling and happy. One of my acquaintances of former years married a woman who had a set of false teeth. One day his wife dropped her teeth and broke the plate. The husband picked up the pieces and began examining them. He showed such interest in them that his wife said, "You could make a set of teeth like those if you made up your mind to do it." This man was a farmer whose ambitions had never carried him beyond the bounds of his little farm until his wife made that remark. She walked over and laid her hand on his shoulder and encouraged him to try his hand at dentistry. She finally coaxed him to make the start, and today he is one of the most prominent and successful dentists in the state of Virginia. I know him well, for he is my father. No one can foretell the possibilities of achievement available to the man whose wife stands at his back and urges him on to a bigger and better endeavor. For it is a well-known fact that a woman can arouse a man so that he will perform almost superhuman feats. It is your right and your duty to encourage your husband and urge him on in worthy undertakings until he should have found his place in the world. You can induce him to put forth greater effort than can any other person in the world. Make him believe that nothing within reason is beyond his power of achievement, and you will have rendered him a service that will go a long way toward helping him win in the battle of life. One of the most successful men in this line of America gives entire credit for success to his wife. When they were first married, she wrote a creed which he signed and placed over his desk. This is the copy of the creed. I believe in myself. I believe in those who work with me. I believe in my employer. I believe in my friends. I believe in my family. I believe that God will lend me everything I need with which to succeed if I do my best to earn it through faithful and honest service. I believe in prayer, and I will never close my eyes in sleep without praying for divine guidance to the end, that I will be patient with other people and tolerant with those who do not believe as I do. I believe that success is the result of intelligent effort and does not depend upon luck or sharp practices or double-crossing friends, fellow men, or my employer. I believe I will get out of life exactly what I put into it. Therefore, I will be careful to conduct myself towards others as I would want them to act towards me. I will not slander those whom I do not like. I will not slight my work no matter what I may see others doing. I will render the best service of myself, which I am capable, because I have pledged myself to succeed in life, and I know that success is always the result of conscientiousness and efficient effort. Finally, I will forgive those who offend me, because I realize that I shall sometimes offend others, and I will need their forgiveness. The woman who wrote this creed was a practical psychologist of the first order. With the influence and guidance of such a woman as a helpmate, any man could achieve noteworthy success. Analyze this creed and you will notice how freely the personal pronoun is used. It starts off with the affirmation of self-confidence, which is perfectly proper. No man can make this creed his own without developing the positive attitude that would attract to him people who would aid him in his struggle for success. This would be a splendid creed for every salesman to adopt. It might not hurt your chances for success if you adopted it. Mere adoption, however, is not enough. You must practice it. Read it over and over until you know it by heart. Then repeat it at least once a day until you have literally transformed it into your mental makeup. Keep a copy of it before as your daily reminder of your pledge to practice it. By doing so, you will be making an efficiency use of the principle of auto-suggestion as a means of developing self-confidence. Never mind what anyone may say about your procedure. Just remember, It is your business to succeed, and this creed, if mastered and applied, will go a long way toward helping you. You learned in Lesson 2 that any idea you firmly fix in your subconscious mind by repeated affirmation automatically becomes a plan or blueprint which an unseen power uses in directing your efforts towards the attainment of the objective mind in that plan. You have also learned that the principle through which you may fix any idea you choose in your mind is called autosuggestion, which simply means a suggestion that you give to your own mind. It was this principle of autosuggestion that Emerson had in mind when he wrote, "Nothing can bring you peace but yourself." You might well remember that nothing can bring you success but yourself. Of course, you will need the cooperation of others if you aim to attain success of a far-reaching nature. But you will never get that cooperation unless you vitalize your mind with the positive attitude of self-confidence. Perhaps you have wondered why a few men advance to highly paid positions while others all around them, who have as much training and who seemingly perform as much work, do not get ahead. Select any two people of these two types that you choose and study them, and the reason why one advances and the other stands still will be quite obvious to you. You will find that the one who advances believes in himself. You will find that he backs his belief with such dynamic, aggressive action that he lets others know that he believes in himself. You will also notice that this self-confidence is contagious. It is impelling. It is persuasive. It attracts others. You will also find that the one who does not advance shows clearly, by the look on his face, by the posture of his body, by the lack of briskness in his step, by the certainty on which he speaks, that he lacks self-confidence. No one is going to pay much attention to the person who has no self-confidence in himself. He does not attract others because his mind is a negative force that repels rather than attracts. In no other field of endeavor does self-confidence, or the lack of it, play such an important part as in the field of salesmanship. And you do not need to be a character analyst to determine, the moment you meet him, whether a salesman possesses this quality of self-confidence. If he has it, the signs of its influence are written all over him. He inspires you with confidence in him and in the goods he is selling the moment he speaks. We come now to the point at which you are ready to take hold of the principle of autosuggestion and make direct use of it in developing yourself into a positive and dynamic and self-reliant person. You are instructed to copy the following formula, sign it, and commit it to memory. Self-confidence formula. First, I know that I have the ability to achieve the object of my definite purpose. Therefore, I demand of myself persistent, aggressive, and continuous action toward its attainment. Second, I realize that the dominating thoughts of my mind eventually reproduce themselves in outward, bodily action, and gradually transform themselves into physical reality. Therefore, I will concentrate my mind for 30 minutes daily upon the task of thinking of the person I intend to be, by creating a mental picture of this person and then transforming that picture into reality through practical service. Third, I know that through the principle of autosuggestion, any desire that I persistently hold in my mind will eventually seek expression through some practical means of realizing it. Therefore, I shall devote 10 minutes daily to demanding of myself the development of the factors named in the 16 lessons of this reading course on the Law of Success. Fourth, I have clearly mapped out and written down a description of my definite purpose in life for the coming 5 years. I have set a price on my service for each of these 5 years, a price that I intend to earn and receive through strict application of the principle of efficient, satisfactory service which I will render in advance. Fifth, I fully realize that no wealth or position can long endure unless built upon truth and justice. Therefore, I will engage in no transactions which does not benefit all whom it affects. I will succeed by attracting to me the forces I wish to use and the cooperation of other people. I will induce others to serve me, because I will first serve them. I will eliminate hatred, envy, jealousy, selfishness, and cynicism by developing love for all humanity, because I know that a negative attitude towards others can never bring me success. I will cause others to believe in me, because I will believe in them and in myself. I will sign my name to this formula, commit it to memory and repeat it aloud once a day with full faith that I will gradually influence my entire life, so that I will become a successful and happy worker in my chosen field of endeavor. Before you sign your name to this formula, make sure that you intend to carry out its instructions. Back of this formula lies a law that no man can explain. The psychologists refer to this law as autosuggestion and let it go at that. But you should bear in mind one point about which there is no uncertainty, and that is the fact that whatever this law is, it actually works. Another point to be kept in mind is the fact that just as electricity will turn the wheels of industry and serve mankind in a million other ways or snuff out life if wrongly applied, so will this principle of autosuggestion lead you up the mountainside of peace and prosperity, or down into the valley of misery and poverty, according to the application you make of it. If you fill your mind with doubt and unbelief in your ability to achieve, then the principle of autosuggestion takes this spirit of unbelief and sets it up in your subconscious mind as your dominating thought and slowly but surely draws you into the whirlpool of failure. But if you fill your mind with radiant self-confidence, the principle of autosuggestion takes this belief and sets it up as your dominating thought and helps you master the obstacles that fall in your way until you reach the mountaintop of success. The power of habit. Having myself experienced all the difficulties that stand in the road of those who lack the understanding to make practical application of this great principle of autosuggestion, let me take you a short way into the principle of habit, through the aid of which you may easily apply the principle of autosuggestion in any direction and for any purpose whatsoever. Habit grows out of environment, out of doing the same thing or thinking the same thoughts or repeating the same words over and over again. Habit may be likened to the groove on a phonograph record, while the human mind may be likened to the needle that fits into that groove. When any habit has been well formed through repetition of thoughts or action, the mind has a tendency to attach itself to and follow the course of that habit as closely as the phonograph needle follows the groove in the wax record. Habit is created by repeatedly directing one or more of the five senses of seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling in a given direction. It is through this repetition principle that the injurious drug habit is formed. It is through this same principle that the desire for intoxicating drink is formed into a habit. After habit has been well established, it will automatically control and direct our bodily activity, wherein may be found a thought that can be transformed into a powerful factor in the development of self-confidence. The thought is this: voluntarily, and by force if necessary, direct your efforts and your thoughts along a desired line until you have formed the habit that will lay hold of you, and continue voluntarily to direct your efforts along the same line. The object in writing out and repeating the self-confidence formula is to form the habit of making belief in yourself the dominating thought of your mind until that thought has been thoroughly embedded in your subconscious mind through the principle of habit. You learned to write by repeatedly directing the muscles of your arm and hand over certain outlines known as letters, until finally you formed the habit of tracing these outlines. Now you write with ease and rapidity, without tracing each letter slowly. Writing has become a habit with you. The principle of habit will lay hold of the faculties of your mind, just the same as it will influence the physical muscles of your body, as you can easily prove by mastering and applying this lesson on self-confidence. Any statement that you repeatedly make to yourself, or any desire that you deeply plant in your mind through repeated statement, will eventually seek expression through your physical, outward, bodily efforts. The principle of habit is the very foundation upon which this lesson on self-confidence is built. And if you will understand and follow the directions laid down in this lesson, you will soon know more about the law of habit from first-hand experience than could be taught you by 1,000 such lessons as this. You have but little conception of the possibilities which lie sleeping within you, awaiting but the awakening hand of vision to arouse you. And you will never have a better conception of those possibilities unless you develop sufficient self-confidence to lift you above the commonplace influences of your present environment. The human mind is a marvelous, mysterious piece of machinery, a fact of which I was reminded a few months ago when I picked up Emerson's essays and reread his essay on spiritual laws. A strange thing happened. I saw in that essay, which I had read scores of times previously, much that I had never noticed before. I saw more in this essay than I had seen during previous readings, because the unfoldment of my mind since the last reading had prepared me to interpret more. The human mind is constantly unfolding, like the petals of a flower, until it reaches the maximum of development. What this maximum is, where it ends, or whether it ends at all or not, are unanswerable questions. But the degree of unfoldment seems to vary according to the nature of the individual and the degree to which he keeps his mind at work. A mind that is forced or coaxed into analytical thought every day seems to keep on unfolding and developing greater powers of interpretation. Down in Louisville, Kentucky, lives Mr. Lee Cook, a man who has practically no legs and has to wheel himself around on a cart. In spite of the fact that Mr. Cook has been without legs since birth, he is the owner of a great industry and a millionaire through his own efforts. He has proved that a man can get along very well without legs if he has a well-developed self-confidence. In the city of New York, one may see a strong, able-bodied, and able-headed young man without legs rolling himself down Fifth Avenue every afternoon, with a cap in hand, begging for a living. His head is perhaps as sound and as able to think as the average. This young man could duplicate anything that Mr. Cook of Louisville has done, if he thought of himself as Mr. Cook thinks of himself. Henry Ford owns more millions of dollars than he will ever need or use. Not so many years ago, he was working as a laborer in a machine shop, with but little schooling and without capital. Scores of other men, some of them with better organized brain than his, worked near him. Ford threw off the poverty consciousness, developed confidence in himself, thought of success and attained it. Those who worked around him could have done as well had they thought as he did. Milo C. Jones of Wisconsin was stricken down with paralysis a few years ago. So bad was the stroke that he could not turn himself in bed or move a muscle of his body. His physical body was useless, but there was nothing wrong with his brain. So it began to function in earnest, probably for the first time in its existence. Lying flat on his back in bed, Mr. Jones made that brain create a definite purpose. That purpose was prosaic and humble enough in nature, but it was definite and it was a purpose, something that he had never known before. His definite purpose was to make pork sausage. Calling his family around him, he told of his plans and began directing them and carrying the plans into action. With nothing to aid him except a sound mind and plenty of self-confidence, Milo C. Jones spread the name and reputation of Little Pig Sausage all over the United States and accumulated a fortune besides. All this was accomplished after paralysis had made it impossible for him to work with his hands. Where thought prevails, power may be found. Henry Ford has made millions of dollars and is still making millions of dollars each year because he believed in Henry Ford and transformed that belief into a definite purpose and backed that purpose with a definite plan. The other machinist who worked along with Ford during the early days of his career visioned nothing but a weekly pay envelope, and that was all they ever got. They demanded nothing out of the ordinary of themselves. If you want to get more, be sure to demand more of yourself. Notice that this demand is to be made on yourself. There comes to mind a well-known poem whose author expressed a great psychological truth. If you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you like to win, but you think you can't, it is almost certain you won't. If you think you'll lose, you've lost. For out of the world we'll find, success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in the state of mind. If you think you are outclassed, you are. You've got to think high to rise. You've got to be sure of yourself before you can ever win a prize. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man, but sooner or late, the man who wins is the man who thinks he can. It can do no harm if you commit this poem to memory and use it as part of your working equipment in the development of self-confidence. Somewhere in your makeup, there is a subtle something which, if it were aroused by the proper outside influence, would carry you to heights of achievement such as you have never before anticipated. Just as a master player can take hold of a violin and cause that instrument to pour forth the most beautiful and entrancing strains of music, so is there some outside influence that can lay hold of your mind and cause you to go forth into the field of your chosen endeavor and play a glorious symphony of success. No man knows what hidden forces lie dormant within you. You yourself do not know your capacity for achievement, and you never will know until you come in contact with that particular stimulus which arouses you to greater action and extends your vision, develops your self-confidence, and moves you with a deeper desire to achieve. It is not unreasonable to expect that some statement, some idea, or some stimulating word of this reading course on the law of success will serve as that needed stimulus that will reshape your destiny and redirect your thoughts and energy along a pathway that will lead you finally to your coveted goal of life. It is strange but true that the most important turning points of life often come at the most unexpected time and in the most unexpected ways. I have in mind a typical example of how some of the seemingly unimportant experiences of life often turn out to be the most important of all. And I am relating this ease because it shows also what a man can accomplish when he awakens to a full understanding of the value of self-confidence. The incident to which I refer happened in the city of Chicago while I was engaged in the work of character analysis. One day a tramp presented himself at my office and asked for an interview. As I looked up from my work and greeted him, he said, "I have come to see the man who wrote this little book." As he removed from his pocket a copy of a book entitled Self-Confidence, which I had written many years previously. "It must have been the hand of fate," he continued, "that slipped this book into my pocket yesterday afternoon, because I was ready to go out there and punch a hole in Lake Michigan. I had about come to the conclusion that everything and everybody, including God, had it in for me until I read this book. And it gave me a new viewpoint and brought me the courage and the hope that sustained me through the night. I made up my mind that if I could see the man who wrote this book, he could help me get on my feet again. Now I am here, and I would like to know what you can do for a man like me." While he was speaking, I had been studying him from head to toe, and I am frank to admit that down deep in my heart, I did not believe there was anything I could do for him. But I did not wish to tell him so. The glassy-eyed stare in his eyes, the lines of discouragement in his face, the posture of his body, the 10 days' growth of beard on his face, the nervous manner about this man all conveyed to me the impression that he was hopeless. But I did not have the heart to tell him so. Therefore, I asked him to sit down and tell me his whole story. I asked him to be perfectly frank and tell me, as nearly as possible, just what had brought him down to the ragged edge of life. I promised that after I had heard his entire story, I would then tell him whether or not I could be of any service to him. He related his story in lengthy detail, the sum and substance of which was this. He had invested his entire fortune in a small manufacturing business. When the World War began in 1914, it was impossible for him to get the raw materials necessary in the operation of his factory, and he therefore failed. The loss of his money broke his heart and so disturbed his mind that he left his wife and children and became a tramp.